So, my latest pandemic fascination is with this 4,500-year-old board game, very popular in Asia. In China, it's called Wei Qi, and in Korea, they call it Paduk, and in Japan, they call it Go. So, one story is that this emperor invented it because he thought his son was a bit dumb. And the game would teach him how to make better life decisions. And boy, did it ever catch on. In ancient China, it became something every cultured gentleman must know how to play well, along with reciting poetry, reading, writing calligraphy, and playing an instrument. The premise is very simple. Two sides, black stones against white stones on a 19 by 19 grid, which is the sort of metaphor for the many possibilities of life. So black goes first. And for that first stone, there are 361 possible placement anywhere where the lines intersect. And then now white goes, and white now has 360 possibilities, one less. And the two players would just sort of continue to take turns putting down a stone. Each decision by one player is answered by a choice by the other player. And the objective is to surround the part of the board and stake out territories to score points. There are only a couple of rules: how to connect your stones to kind of build a sort of fence, and how to surround your opponent's stones to capture them. So, sounds simple, right? That's what I thought. And then I played my first game against the computer, and within a few turns, I was completely confused. I was just putting down stones randomly. Now, I wasn't just making bad moves. I didn't even know what moves I was making. And it felt like some decisions I have made in my life when I couldn't figure out what the decision was. And I just ended up taking a stab in the dark. So, needless to say, I lost very badly to the computer, which then led me to my first lesson of the game: how to handle the emotions of defeat and failure. So, someone writing about the game says, "It takes a minute to learn, but a lifetime to master." Psalm 1 feels like that to me. It sounds very simple. Live this way and be blessed. Do evil and be blown away like chaff. It sounds simple until we discover real life is complicated. Life choices can be really hard. And once in a while, we find ourselves feeling like a failure. So Psalm 1 proposes a very straightforward strategy for life. There's a blank slate, endless possibilities. All our life choices are summed up by three verbs: walk, stand, and sit. So blessed is the one who does not walk in step with the wicked, or stand in the way that sinners take, or sit in the company of mockers, but whose delight is in the law of the Lord and who meditates on his law day and night. So make our choices according to God's core values and reap blessings for ourselves and others. That person, verse 2, is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season and whose leaf does not wither. Whatever they do, prosper. Alternatively, our choices can do harm to ourselves and others. And when we consistently make hurtful choices, we leave behind a sort of wasteland, a wake of destruction. So, verse 4, not so the wicked. They're like chaff and the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked leads to destruction. And verse 2 says, follow God's instruction. They will teach us how to make choices that create blessing and avoid the wasteland, the way the emperor invented a game to train his son. Well, like the board game, that sounds simple enough, except we know very well life is hardly that straightforward, which is sort of the point of the story of Job, who apparently did everything right and still his life went into the dumpster. And who of us can even claim, as Job does, that we do everything God says perfectly, that we're faultless in every action, every choice, every intention and motive? So I don't think Psalm 1 is entirely instructional, nothing that simple. Rather, it is the introduction to all the Psalms, reminding us about the world God intended before everything went wrong. Much like that lush garden at the beginning of Genesis, that life, that was life in God intended for humans before humans chose poorly. And it was just a couple of page turns after the garden when the first couple found themselves in wasteland and sent humanity down the road that became our history. Now, according to Genesis, when God put Adam and Eve into the garden, there was one seemingly simple thing God asked them to respect, one simple rule for life in the garden with God. God asked them to not eat from that one tree in the middle of the garden. That tree is called the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And it symbolizes a theological idea in the Bible that while God created human beings to live freely, there's such a thing as good and evil. And our choices do affect reality, either in a good way or in a bad way. Now, God still entrusts us with choice. He only asks that we use our freedom responsibly. That I not only choose what is good for me, but I would also consider what is good for you and what is good for God and what is good for the world. For the first couple in the garden, to trust God and choose not to eat from that one tree was for their own good. That was also good for the garden and was good for their relationship with God. But it didn't take very long for them to decide that eating from the tree was better than not eating from the tree. And they became obsessed with the tree. And at some point, they forgot about consequences. So in the end, that bite of fruit represented a declaration of total independence. They chose to abandon their relationship with God and life in the garden, and instead to make life happen for themselves in the wilderness as their own bosses. And very quickly, violence became the way to solve problems between people, the way to win at all costs. That's what happens when every person who lives, that's what happens when every person only lives for what is good for himself or herself, with no consideration for the greater good of others. It's chaos. And it's what happens when we exercise freedom without any sense of virtue or purpose. It's me trying to play Go, just dropping my stones down randomly, making a mess of the board, leading to my own downfall. When the Jewish people put the prayer book together, I suspect they had this storyline in mind, because after that introduction, Psalm 1, of a very neat description of a black and white world between life in a lush garden with God or abandoning God to figure out things on our own and end up in wasteland, the next few Psalms illustrate that rapid decline into chaos. So Psalm 2 begins with, "Why do the nations conspire and the people plot in vain?" And then Psalm 3 begins with, "Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me?" The answer to these questions are, well, this is what happens when every person is just out for themselves. When everybody just wants to win at all costs, and it doesn't matter who loses and who gets hurt in the process. There are apparently two ways to play that board game. One way is to play aggressively to win at all costs. One person describes it this way, fighting and killing every step of the way. But people who play this way say they're just being practical, no nonsense. So there's a Chinese man in China who goes to a park every day to watch other people play, but he himself, he says, does not play anymore because he has a bad heart and playing is just too stressful. But there's another way to play, which is to take time to make a harmonious looking board, to create nice shapes with the stones. People who play this way don't really care about winning so much. Instead, it's about working together building trust, getting to know each other, trusting your opponent to work with you and not take advantage of you and eat you, leaving you when you leave yourself vulnerable. So Sun Tzu in The Art of War says, the best strategy for war is to avoid the fight. And apparently one of the late CEOs of Nintendo would not ink a deal with anyone until they had sat down and play a game of Go together. So the two ways to play Go, it's just like real life. Psalm 1 says there are two paths, two ways to live. There's the win at all costs way, no matter who gets hurt. Or there's the blessing life, when we let virtue guide our use of freedom in the choices we make, bearing fruit that feeds the world and leaves a good smell. Sounds simple enough, but so hard to do, apparently, because at the moment, it seems there's a fruit shortage in the world. So by the time the Jewish people got the psalm into the prayer book, they were waving the white flag in defeat. Maybe it's the human ego, or maybe our need to win runs too deep. They wanted to be that orchard in Psalm 1, but they couldn't do it. And they began looking to God for help, to send a savior, a messiah to come and rescue them, to lead them from wasteland back to that fertile place next to the river. Like all the times in the Bible when God's people cried out to him for help, and when God answered their prayer and intervened, seems to me, it was always to redirect their use of freedom and give their lives a purpose. Like when God sought out Abraham, he offered to make him and his descendants a people of blessing. Or when God, through Moses, gave the people the Ten Commandments as a moral compass to how to use the freedom to make choices towards the blessing life. So don't get pulled into religious slavery. That's the first three. Don't be enslaved to your work. That's number four. And don't trample on your neighbor's freedom by taking their life or their wife or their good name or their stuff. So that's the rest of it. And then 2000 years ago, God launched the mother of all rescue plans when Jesus, God the Son, came in person in a human body to actually show us how to live the fruitful, blessing life. He invites us to join him to replant that Genesis garden in the wasteland, that orchard in Psalm 1. First, by reestablishing relationship with our Creator, and then by living life with God's Spirit as our freedom coach. I wouldn't be surprised if Paul had Psalm 1 in mind when he wrote to the Galatians about the fruit of the Spirit. The qualities that are blessings to any relationships: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. All the things that sound simple, but so hard to do by our own willpower, because they don't come from willpower. These are the natural results of relationship with God, Father, Son, and Spirit. God will grow the blessing fruit in us if we let him, and cooperate with the Spirit's nudges. So ultimately, Jesus came to inspire us with a new mindset to winning and losing. That the key to the blessing life is to be willing at times to choose to lose to help other people get a win. That is, blessing begins with us tethering our freedom to the virtue of Spirit-guided humility. Now, in everyday language, we understand humility as a kind of modesty. But on a grander scale, humility is about seeing ourselves as belonging in a greater thing and choosing at times to set aside self-interest to serve the greater good. And so we have Paul's anthem in Philippians about Jesus as the ultimate example of humility. He had equal status with God, but didn't think so much of himself that he had to cling to the advantages of that status no matter what. Not at all. When the time came, he set aside the privileges of deity and took on the status of a slave became human, having become human, he stayed human. It was an incredibly humbling process. He didn't claim special privileges. Instead, he lived a selfless, obedient life and died a selfless, obedient death, and the worst kind of death at that, a crucifixion. That's Philippians 2:5-8 in the Message. That even God, the most powerful being in the universe, doesn't live for his own self-interest, but instead has thrown in his lot with us so that we're now in it together. Jesus traded his godness for a mortal body, risked his life, suffered and died in order to bring us resurrection life that begins before we die by letting God grow fruit in us. There's a theologian in Australia who used to be a rock star, a real one. And his name is John Dixon, and he wrote a book on humility. So according to him, humility was not even considered a virtue before Jesus. We have all these ancient lists of virtues by philosophers, and humility is not on any one of them. And the Romans in Jesus's time were not at all impressed with a God who would allow himself to be killed at human hands. As shown in a cartoon that archaeologists have discovered, which shows Jesus's body hanging on a cross, but it has the head of a donkey. And the caption says, "Alexamenos worships as God." But Dixon explains that actually, this is the difference between humility and humiliation. The soldiers set out to humiliate Jesus, which is when someone degrades someone else's dignity. But from Jesus's point of view, he chose to let them. This is humility. When someone chooses service or sacrifice, the dignity is not diminished. Instead, it is dignity in action. And Jesus's humility is an affirmation of his love of humanity, that we are community and our well-being are intertwined. So as the early Christians grappled with why Jesus died on a cross, they began to understand that it was about spirit-guided humility. It was Jesus showing us the way to the blessing life. He was willing to set aside self-interest and get a bigger win for everybody, to serve the greater good, because we're all part of something bigger. That even as God, his own well-being was not the end-all of everything. Instead, he did and continues to do what is good for all creation and us in creation. So Paul introduces his humanity anthem in Philippians 2 by saying, think of yourself the way Christ Jesus thought of himself. That's how we get back to that orchard in Psalm 1, by replanting a garden in wasteland, by letting God's Spirit coach us into emulating Jesus's humility in our choices, a virtuous use of freedom to create blessing. So with all the companies trying to, in a mad race to create a self-driving car, there's a problem they have yet to figure out how to solve. There's an old ethical dilemma called the trolley problem. So here's my version of it. You are in your car driving down Main Street when you realize there's a red light and your brakes are not working. There's a crowd of people crossing the street in front of you, and you're about to crash into them. But in a split second, you notice there's a side lane with one person in it. You have one chance to steer your car away from the crowd into the lane, but you're going to hit that person for sure. And the question is, what is the right thing to do? On the one hand, if we're being practical, hurting one person is better than hurting a crowd, right? But on the other hand, that person was minding his own business, wasn't even on the main road, and hurting him would be a deliberate choice on your part, the driver. And that guy would say, wait a second, you didn't even ask me before deciding to hit me, and that somehow that was better than hitting the crowd. So this is one of those impossible choices in life with no good answer. Now, think if you're the guy who has to program the car to make this decision, what would you do? And who would be legally liable for the outcome? Who would get sued at the end? So here's what Jesus did. As he eyed the crowd and the guy in the lane, he ran the car off the road and sacrificed himself so no one else would get hurt. Jesus found a third way that turned out to be quite simple. If we were prepared to choose to accept the short end of the stick for the good of everyone else. Now, hopefully, none of our life choices will have, none of us will have to face a life choice that dramatic in real life, that maybe our heroics would mostly be on the scale of just choosing to be kind when we don't feel like it, like overlooking a slight from a stranger or letting go of a grudge or holding our tongue when we got a zinger all queued up to go or putting on a mask. Humility is this couple in Florida who has this orange and tangerine grove in their backyard. I stayed in their house during one of my singing trips. And I said to the lady, it must be nice to have fruit that fresh in the morning for breakfast. And she said, yes, but there's one downside. Our neighbor likes to jump over the fence and take fruit off our trees in the morning for breakfast. We wouldn't mind so much if he would just not do it in his underwear. So, humility is sharing the fruit with the neighbor and just not looking out the window, that time in the morning. Humility is a story John Dixon tells in the book about this man who was sitting in the back of the bus, minding his own business, when three hooligans started picking on him, and he just sort of had to ignore them for the rest of the bus ride. When the man got to the stop, he stood up from his chair and he was actually much bigger than the hooligans. And it turned out he was Joe Louis, the heavyweight boxing champion of the world. And Dixon wrote this. This story is emblematic of Louis's whole life. Raised in poverty by former slave parents, Louis never forgot his lowly beginnings and saw his successes as opportunities to give back something of what he had received. Louis was generous to a fault and even paying back the city of Detroit for all the welfare monies his family had received in the earlier years. But he is remembered not only for his unparalleled boxing achievements, but also for his willingness to hold power in service of others, for his humility. And then there's this story I read last weekend on the 9/11 anniversary. Wandering around the Albuquerque airport terminal, after hearing my flight had been delayed 4 hours, I heard an announcement. If anyone in the vicinity of Gate 8-4 understands any Arabic, please come to the gate immediately. Well, one pauses these days. Gate 8-4 was my own gate. I went there. An older woman in full traditional Palestinian embroidered dress, just like my grandma wore, was crumpled to the floor, wailing. Help, said the flight agent. Talk to her. What is her problem? We told her the flight was going to be late, and she did this. I stopped to put my arm around the woman and spoke haltingly in Arabic. The minute she heard any word she knew, however poorly used, she stopped crying. She thought the flight had been canceled entirely. She needed to be in El Paso for major medical treatment the next day. I said, no, we're fine. You'll get there just later. Who's picking you up? Let's call him. We called her son. I spoke to him in English. I told him I would stay with his mother till we got on the plane and ride next to her. She talked to him, and then we called her other sons just for the fun of it. Then we called my dad. And he and her spoke for a while in Arabic and found out, of course, they had 10 shared friends. Then I thought, just for the heck of it, why not call some Palestinian poets I know and let them chat with her? This all took 2 hours. She was laughing a lot by then, telling of her life, patting my knee, answering questions. She had pulled a sack of homemade mamoul cookies, little powdered sugar crumbly mounts stuffed with dates and nuts, from her bag. and was offering them to all the women at the gate. To my amazement, not a single woman declined one. It was like a sacrament. The traveler from Argentina, the mom from California, the lovely woman from Laredo, we were all covered with the same powdered sugar and smiling. There's no better cookie. And then the airline broke out free apple juice from huge coolers, and two little girls from our flight ran around serving it and were covered with powdered sugar too. And I noticed my new best friend, by now we were holding hands, had a potted plant poking out of her bag, some medicinal thing with green furry leaves. Such an old country tradition. Always carry a plant. Always stay rooted in something. And I look around the gate of late and weary ones, and I thought, this is the world I want to live in, the shared world. Not a single person in the gate, once the crying and confusion stopped, seemed apprehensive about any other person. They took the cookies. I want to hug all those other women. This can still happen anywhere. Not everything is lost. So, while our acts of sacrifices might be less heroic than Jesus, we would not be less humble, because we would be blessing someone, no less. And because we're continuing where Jesus left off, by our own free will to set aside self-interest, to create blessings in the world, because God made us to be in it together. Let me give you a moment to begin a conversation with God, and I will read you Malcolm Guite. This is Malcolm Guite, Psalm 1. Come to the place where every breath is praise and God is breathing through each passing breeze. Be planted by the waterside and raise your arms with Christ beneath these rooted trees who lift their breathing leaves up to the skies. Be rooted too, as still and strong as these, open alike to sun and rain. Arise from meditation by these waters. Bear the fruit of that deep rootedness. Be wise in the trees, long wisdom. Learn to share the secret of the patience, pass the day in the green fastness and the quiet air. Slowly discern a life, a truth, a way, where simple being flowers in the light. And then let the chaff of life just blow away. Amen.